You're listening to another.
Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. May 1st, 2015. Spring finally here, I guess, for most of the country, or at least I hope it is where you are. Always great to join you at the end of the week to play the inevitable game of catch-up. And my goodness gracious, there is so much to catch up on. Those of you who are familiar with me know that I'm a retired senior special agent of the former Immigration and Naturalization Service. My mission, for those of you who are new to this program, is to try to provide my perspectives, my experience, my 40-odd years having dealt with immigration and national security issues in a way that the mainstream media refuses to cover. You know, when 9/11 happened, I was averaging 12, 15 television interviews per month, trying to wake everybody up to understand the nexus between the failures of the immigration system and the way that the terrorists were able to attack our nation, not only on 9/11, but on other occasions, to be able to show people that the risks that we face for not securing our borders and enforcing our immigration laws are having a detrimental effect on America, not because my issue is xenophobia. I live in New York, the most ethnically diverse city arguably in the United States, if not the world. But it's about making certain that we don't allow people who wish to come here to commit crime, to do harm to us, are able to do that. And that's what the immigration laws are about. Nothing in those laws have anything to do with race, religion, or ethnicity, but about protecting America and Americans. So that's been my mission ever since 9/11. But increasingly, the mainstream media refuses to cover the topic. We'll get into it in a bit. In fact, I spoke to a producer at 60 Minutes, and what he had to say was astonishing. But as I say, we will get to it. But first, I want to start out by giving you a couple of websites I'd like you to visit. And then I want to bring on my guest, John Loeffler, who has even more time in radio than I've had in my career with immigration. John's a radio talk show host. I've been on his program, Turnabout Certainly Fair Play, today, so he will be with me in a moment. But I want you folks out there to please go to my personal website, michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. For many years, I have been a senior fellow, a guy who has been writing for Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org, C-A-P-S. They've been doing a phenomenal job, wonderful job of getting that information out there about the issue of immigration and related issues. But, you know, I limit my work with these groups to my expertise on immigration. I believe you should have expertise before you go out there with opinions. Otherwise, it's kind of silly. You know, there really has to be something backing up the positions of advocacy that we take. As my dad used to say, empty barrels make a lot of noise, and he was insistent that if I was going to voice an opinion, it had to be fact-based. And that's what we do on this program. It's fact-based. Also, I write for Progressives for Immigration Reform, and as their name implies, they're on the left. But this is not about left or right. This is about right or wrong. So I write for Progressives for Immigration Reform, Front Page Magazine, a terrific publication, website, and also the product of a wonderful organization known as the David Horowitz Freedom Center. So it's awesome to be writing for them as a columnist. The Social Contract has some of my works up. The Daily Caller has published some of my pieces. So this is about providing that perspective. And with everything that's happened this week, I think you will be amazed to see how immigration even links to what we are now witnessing in Baltimore, Maryland, a town that's close to my heart. Although I'm a New Yorker, that was where my mom first moved to when she entered the United States ahead of the Holocaust as a 14-year-old girl many, many years ago. I since lost her, unfortunately, but I've made many trips to Baltimore, and it breaks my heart to see the chaos, the violence, everything that is now unfolding just a couple of hundred miles from my hometown of New York City. With that, John Loeffler, are you there?
I'm here. Greetings.
Greetings, sir. Thank you so much for joining me on the program. As I said in the intro, a turnabout is fair play. I've been privileged to be on your program, Steel on Steel, twice. So the least I could do was extend the invitation to you to be here. So why don't we start out with you telling my audience who John Loeffler is and how did you come up with a name like Steel on Steel? That's an intriguing name.
This year, you know, you mentioned the time in broadcasting. This is my 50th year in broadcasting. I started in 1965, right in the middle, by the way, of the Watts riots. Remember those things in Los Angeles?
Absolutely,
back in
I do.
Yep. And right in the middle of the, I was in San Francisco working for KCBS News Radio. I was, I think, 20 years old at the time when the riots at Berkeley in San Francisco State started. They were pushed by what I call radical leftists trying to overthrow the system, and was privy to that. That was the same thing that David Horowitz cut his teeth on.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I'm having a senior moment, but I was in Montana 2 weeks ago at the invitation of a great American, and a man that I'm proud to call a personal friend, Major General Paul Vallely, retired Major General who ran Special Forces in Afghanistan. In fact, his son, tragically, a member of Special Forces, lost his life there fighting on behalf of America 10 years ago. But when I went to Montana to do a speaking event, he unfortunately had fallen ill, wasn't able to give me the grand tour. So a gentleman whose first name was Tom, and I feel like a fool for not remembering his last name, but he was the guy who started the SWAT program with the LAPD because of those riots you're speaking about. And to listen to his perspectives was truly amazing.
That was the first time we actually had live coverage. I remember that. They were mounting these big black and white cameras on helicopters and everything else to try to get us coverage. I was in Southern California at the time, and we were able to see this in real time. The rest of the country didn't watch it, but all the local stations were carrying it, you know. And at the time, we were wondering, what's this all about? So Steel on Steel, I got the name of the program because you asked that from Proverbs 27:17. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. And the idea is, if you and I dialogue and debate honestly, we can actually sharpen each other, get rid of those ideas that are bad, and find those ideas that are good. And
well,
then,
I know that I believe you are ordained. Am I correct?
No. I studied to be a Catholic priest for about 2 years. Well, I take that back. I'm sorry. I'm an ordained evangelical pastor right now. But way back in the 70s, I studied to be a Catholic priest.
Okay, because I was reading through your bio. Fascinating background. And you know, what you're speaking about is really at the heart of the democratic process. And you know what I find so disturbing, John? Sometimes you wind up on people's programs without knowing what their background is. I was on a program of a guy who was a part of the John Birch Society. I don't agree with their perspective on many issues, but as Americans, we're entitled to our perspectives. And so I was on this guy's program for about 45 minutes, and for at least 41 or 45 minutes, we really went at it. We were respectful, but boy, oh boy, we were really locking horns. Well, it didn't take 15 minutes before, after I came off the program, it was all over the internet that Mike Cutler was on a program hosted by a member of the John Birch Society, and some of the people that I work with reached out to me and said, why were you on that guy's program? I said, well, number one, I didn't know that he was with the John Birch Society, but number two, I probably still would have gone on the program. And these folks were aghast, and they said, but why? I said, well, in criticizing me, or at least that was the attempt, they talked about the program I was on, but in the dozen or so postings that went up almost spontaneously, was there any comment made about anything that I personally had said or a position that I had taken that was so abhorrent to them? And the answer was no. The whole focus was whose program you were on. I said, what have we become as a country when you get castigated for daring to have a discussion with somebody whose political beliefs are different with you, well, different from you? I mean, think how crazy that is.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we started my show 25 years ago out of Denver, Colorado. I remember when Denver talk show host Peter Boyles, and he is a fixture in Denver talk radio.
Oh, I've been on his program a bunch of times, not lately, but a number of times going back a few years, absolutely.
Yeah, then you know who Pete is. And
sure.
He had, in the early 90s, he said, well, what's with the militias? Why don't we have some militia members on? And just let's find out what they're all about, because the only thing that you know about them is what everybody else is saying about them, right?
Right.
So he did that. Dang, did he catch flack because of that, and it was the same thing. He said, what's wrong with sitting down with a person and saying, what do you believe? And, you know, on the John Birch Society, I'm not a Bircher. I've had some Birchers on my show. We share some common views area, others I disagree with. But when somebody says, you had a member of the John Birch Society, I say, what do the John Birchers believe? What's wrong with the John Birch Society? They stare at me. They can't give me an answer for that. They only know that they knee-jerk and react. And that's where we're dying right now in the culture, is our inability to debate coherently about issues rather than cliches and ad hominem attacks.
Well, but you see, this is really, you know, that there's an expression, I'm sure you've heard it in your travels, that when a lawyer walks into a courtroom and he's strong on the facts and weak on the law, he pounds the facts. When he's weak on the facts and strong on the law, he pounds the law. And when he's weak on both, he pounds the table. So our adversaries, let's talk about immigration for argument's sake. The open borders folks, and I call them the immigration anarchists, these aren't pro-immigrants, try to define their opponents. Why do they do it? Because they know they can't possibly win a debate on the merits of the facts, law, common sense, or morality. And I'm not saying it because I'm on the opposite side from them. I'm just saying it because if you really understand why we have immigration laws and what the goals are, it's pretty clear that this isn't about bigotry, this nonsense. Oh, it's about the Latino voter. There's nothing in the immigration law that treats anybody differently from anyone else with one distinction: citizen versus alien. And that's why, number one, they don't want to use the word alien, because it provides clarity, and the term alien is hardly the N-word. All it means is any person who is not a citizen or national of the United States. That's a statement of fact. It's a legal statement. And every country on the planet uses equivalent language. So what's left is to, number one, or in an Orwellian fashion, change the words, expunge words from the vocabulary, and then go after your opponents by criticizing them so that they will wind up mired in this muck that they've thrown at us. So the point that I make is, no, I'm not anti-immigrant, but I am pro-enforcement. And if you're pro-enforcement, you're actually pro-immigrant, because we admit over 1 million aliens legally, when we say legally, in adherence with the law. But, you see, it takes the ability to debate, which comes back to my principal premise about education. I don't think anybody should be able to get a diploma or a degree without at least a full year on the debating team. My degree was in communications, arts, and sciences, or as I prefer to say, I have a BA in BS. But I was on the debating team. I was on the debating teams. I thought you'd like that, John. I was on the debating teams in high school and college. I never lost a debate. It's the only place where we're taught to ask questions. And, of course, being a Jew from Brooklyn, we're predisposed to ask questions because, you know, Jews are supposed to answer questions with another question. So I guess it comes naturally to me. But we've lost that art. We've lost the ability to sit down, even with people we're diametrically opposed with, and do exactly what you were talking about. Have that discourse, have that discussion. And that's why the right for peaceable assemblage is in the First Amendment of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. The idea of have that debate, have the argument if need be. All they said is leave your guns, your clubs, and your knives out of it. Do it verbally. Don't get violent. But this is at the heart of democracy. And look at what we've done as a country. If you disagree, you've become the enemy. And then the nasty stuff starts, and it's designed to shut down debate and discourse. That's really what's going on in America today.
Yeah, we haven't lost it. We've allowed it to be pushed off, well, almost off the table. But I'm going to speak tomorrow at a conference of evangelicals, as a matter of fact, on where trends are going in the Middle East. But when I talk to them about rights in this country, said, you need to understand this is not a left or right issue. Our rights are becoming fungible. They're being changed as we watch them. We're moving into what some are calling an oligarchic dictatorship comprised of unelected, unaccountable, faceless bureaucrats spewing out thousands of regulations. But when I say now we cannot submit to that tyranny anymore, and I'm talking not the government here, I'm talking about the tyranny of language, I will not sit down, I will not shut up. Do you have an answer to my question, yes or no? That's the answer. Is it true? Not is it politically correct?
I couldn't agree with you more. You're literally doing God's work, whether it's as an evangelical or as an American, because we really need to stand up and say this is enough. We have got to stop allowing these schoolyard bullies to carry this nonsense out. I've had the privilege of addressing the Tea Party convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, on three separate occasions. So now think about it. I'm registered as a Democrat. Joe Dugan, the organizer, great guy. He's got such energy. He's at least a decade older than I am. And this guy has the enthusiasm of somebody who's a third or a quarter his age. And he knows my background. Not only did they have me speak, they gave me prime time, 25 minutes each time. Now, that's what America is supposed to be about. Even if we disagree on some issues, we are bound to agree on other issues. But let's hear each other out, and we don't always have the answers. Sometimes I listen to somebody, and I say, gee whiz, I hadn't considered that. I was wrong on this issue. And sometimes people will say to me, gee whiz, Mike, I didn't realize this other thing, but now that you've said that, I was wrong and you're right. I mean, the meeting of the minds is so profound and so empowering, and that's what we really need to push for. To be able to have honest conversation, to treat each other fairly and with dignity and with respect, to learn how to disagree without making enemies of those that we disagree with. I don't think the people who disagree with me are my enemies. They're simply my opponents on that issue, and the way I look at them, really, are allies if only I can win them over.
And usually you think reason discourse could do it. That's what I started when I got out of other phases of broadcasting 25 years ago. I thought, you know, if we can just get on the air and begin reasonably talking people through the issues, we can get to the conclusions and we'll make the right decisions and everything will get better. And I discovered, boy, was that naive. because what I discovered is a lot of people aren't interested in the right conclusions. They have agendas. And remember that one of the most famous things that David Horowitz says that I think is really perceptive is that when you're dealing with what I call the real hardcore elitist, and I make a difference between progressives and liberals today, the real hardcore progressives, he said, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the outcome, and any intermediate issue is merely a means to the outcome of the issue. That's really critical to understand, because when you're dealing with change agentry, which is what it's called, they will take one position on a sub-issue and the exact opposite on another sub-issue as long as both of those things get you to the ultimate objective, which he basically says is always power and money. And that's important to remember about politics. But you're right. The and this is disgusting to me, especially in colleges. I interviewed Dr. Peter Wood this week with the National Association of Scholars, and he was also at King's College in New York City, right near you. And he's talking about the whole new religion on college campuses called sustainability. And he said the problem with sustainability is we don't know what it means, but nobody's allowed to dissent from it. You know, and so this is what he's arguing is we need this same kind of inquiry in academics. You have to realize that the one place where we used to have it, it's disappearing. And that's on college campuses and to a second level on high school campuses. You know, let me give you an example. Back in 1995, I wanted to start jumping into the racial issues. And just, Michael, like you said, ask the hard questions. And the hard question I was going to say is, you know, I remember the Civil Rights Movement, 1964. I remember the marches, Dr. Martin Luther King. And I agreed with that because even when I was a kid, I thought segregation was stupid and unfair.
Yes.
And theoretically, the goal was to take the African-American community and spool them up to bring them up into the mainstream of society. Now, the Asian community that we have here largely came here, Michael, right as a result of what happened in Vietnam, from Cambodia, from Vietnam, from Laos.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even speak the language.
Yeah. Yep.
They have set up shop. One of my son's best friends, his family is South Korean. They've set up shop. They've made themselves very prosperous. They don't riot, blah, blah, blah. And I said, during the very same time, the African-American community flopped around. What happened? What went wrong? I've watched this for 50 years, you know.
Yep.
And my producer, Donette, at the time said, you can't ask that question. I said, why not? It's a reasonable question. I'd like to get some leaders from the black community here and have them answer that question. And she said, you'll be called a racist. I said, but it's just a reasonable question. And that's, you know, that was my first real upset in this whole area. Finally, I did have a friend of mine who's an African-American pastor from inner city Los Angeles who also teaches at a local college. He teaches philosophy. And he came on the show, and this was almost 20 years later, and finally gave me the long answer to why that is. But the point was, I couldn't even ask the question, you know. And
well,
it's like I said, when somebody says...
But those are valid questions, and the point you made is right. And by the way, if you look at the Jews who came here after the Holocaust, or ahead of the Holocaust, as my mom did, it was the same deal. Most did not speak English. My dad's family came here from Russia, Romania, around 1908, didn't speak a word of English. First order of business was to learn English. And to try to become part of the tapestry. But the problem that we have in America today, and I'd be curious to know, and I want you to answer the question, what that black pastor had to say. But, you know, I don't know if you saw the prosecutor in Baltimore do a news conference today to announce the indictment of the six police officers. Did you see it?
I didn't see the press conference, no.
My God, it took my breath away. You know, I'm a law enforcement officer. I spent 30 years with the INS, still very much involved with law enforcement issues. In my life, I had never heard a statement like that, and certainly I've been involved with many prosecutions. I worked on a murder case. I worked on terrorism investigations and so forth. The first thing she said basically was, we've indicted these guys. I could hear the young people. This is for you. Words to that effect. The judicial process is a deliberative process. It is supposed to be, in the words of Jack Webb, just about the facts. And I don't know these cops. I don't know if they're black, white, purple, have yellow polka dots. I don't know what their backgrounds are. I don't know what their histories are. If this is the umpteenth time that they've been in a mess because of something they did do or didn't do, or if this is the first time. I know nothing about them. But here's what disturbed me. To have a prosecutor come out and not talk about a preponderance of evidence, but to talk about how this is dedicated to the young people who are out on the street. Are we hanging scalps on our belt now? Are we going to indict people to placate the masses? I mean, then we're talking about, which is a contradiction in terms, a legal or legally justified public lynching. The law must be the issue. The facts must be the issue. And if at the end of the day the facts show that these guys committed a murder, then they need to go to jail. End of story, party over. But when the prosecutor comes out there and basically says we're doing this because of all the anger on the streets, is that what our judicial system has become? Am I being unreasonable, John?
No, because the issue, I mean, how many Latinos are shot, say, for example, by police, maybe in an unjust way? The issue, and this is where we've got it distorted. Remember, Martin Luther King's dream was that no one should be judged by the color of their skin. Now
right.
We do everything else, but it's a litmus test that we discuss everything in these
racial. Let me tell you what, there are dopey cops, like in every other profession. You have some of the, I mean, look, 30 years in law enforcement, I had the privilege of working closely with the NYPD, with other police departments, with other federal agencies. Half my career was with the Drug Task Force. I had a desk in police precincts. And 99% of the cops I worked with were amazing. But there are always going to be some boneheads. And there's going to be boneheads who are federal agents who get into the profession for the wrong reasons, as do doctors, as do lawyers, as, you know, all sorts of professions hopefully weed out the people that shouldn't be doing those jobs. But every now and then, some knucklehead gets in who shouldn't be there. I've had a couple of encounters with cops who didn't realize I was an agent and so forth. And, you know, I'm clearly a white guy, and they were white, but, you know, it got real nasty. And what was wrong? The cop was a bonehead. But if you immediately say, oh, you had that encounter because it was a black guy and a white cop, is that really what happened? I'll give you a quick example. I was just telling this to a friend of mine today. I was double parking, anticipating this old gentleman who had just gotten into his car was going to pull out so I could park my car. And I was in a congested part of New York City, and, you know, Brooklyn, New York is wall-to-wall cars. And this guy was moving glacially. He had to be at least, I kid you not, 90 years old. I'm not sure if this guy should even be driving. He was having trouble coordinating his walking. He had this big cane that he was, you know, schlepping along with. And he got into the car, and a car, police car, pulls up next to me. Two young cops, and the guy says to me, hey, move your car. You can't double park. I said, officer, forgive me, I'm not double parking. There's an old gentleman in that car. As soon as he pulls out, there's no parking here. I've been circling the block for the last 15 minutes. As soon as he pulls out, I'll be pulling in. I don't give a damn what you're doing. Move the car. And we wound up having a back-and-forth argument that went on for about 10 minutes. And finally, the old man pulled his car out, and I pulled into the spot. This guy wanted to continue the argument. And I said, you're wrong on the penal code. You're wrong on everything you're telling me. You're wrong on traffic law. I wasn't obstructing traffic. You're entitled to double park if someone's pulling out, and he was pulling out, albeit slowly. And then I finally said, you know, he said, what do you know about the law? I said, well, I'm retired, but I was a federal agent for 30 years. And he just gave me this odd look and drove off. But, you see, if someone had witnessed the same kind of an encounter, and if I was black, they would have said, oh, that cop was being a racist. We are too quick to jump to a conclusion that if someone disagrees with somebody, that it's the guy's skin color that was at the root cause of the disagreement. This was just a dopey cop. You see what I'm saying?
And you know what? I tell people when you get into traffic stop situations, just first of all, whenever you're dealing with that, you're dealing with a legal issue. So I say, if you can do it in your state, record it. That's the first thing, okay, because it's a legal type thing. But second of all, I know what cops go through. I've got friends who are cops at all different levels, and I understand what they go through. Be polite to the officer. Give him what he wants. If he goes too far, then you say, wait a minute, how is that germane to the stop, you know?
Yep. And what I've told my son, when my son got his driver's license, I said, listen, you get pulled over by a cop at night, this is what you do, period. Lights on in the interior in the car. If you have your friends with you, tell them to put their hands on their kneecaps. You put your hands on top of your steering wheel, put the flashers on, and put the car either in park or neutral. It was a stick shift. I had an old Maxima with a stick. Or turn the engine off, but make sure you got the flashers on, the interior light on. Car stops are one of the most dangerous things that a law enforcement officer can do. There may be weapons in the car. There's a whole bunch of things that can go very wrong very quickly. So comply, and then we'll work through it. And, you know, this isn't about, and my son obviously is a white kid. So, again, we're not talking color. We're just talking about an encounter with law enforcement and how you need to deal with it so that the cop doesn't feel that he's at risk and you do what you need to do to handle things in a proper fashion. But what's happening now, and I'm listening to what the president is saying, and I'm listening to what Clinton is saying, and suddenly this is about the whites versus the blacks, and I'm listening and I'm saying, wait a minute, why are you doing this? And why are we ignoring some pretty obvious things that are happening here? And I don't understand the Black Caucus for the life of me, because this comes back to immigration. We have given away so many jobs to people from other countries. We are now admitting legally probably twice as many aliens entitled to work in the United States legally as the number of new jobs that are being created. What this is doing is driving down wages and displacing American workers. And if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there was one chart that talked about tenured workers and the percentage of blacks who have lost their jobs who've been working for 3 years or more in a particular job is astonishing. For whites as well, but the black community is getting hammered the worst. So if you keep taking people's jobs and capacity to earn a reasonable paycheck from them by these practices, what is it that you're going to expect to see happen on the street? And now Hillary is at it again with wage equality. I don't know if I discussed this with you on your program, But Alan Greenspan's idea of wage equality is to narrow the gap between the middle class and poor by making middle class workers compete with foreign workers to eliminate what he came to refer to as the wage premium, so that they would no longer be the privileged elite. I want to know in what twisted universe the middle class is perceived as the privileged elite. But those were Greenspan's words at an April 30th, 2009 hearing when he testified before Chuck Schumer. And he said he wanted to greatly reduce wage inequality between Americans with skills and no skills. So what are we saying? Even if you get the degree, you still won't earn much more than the guy that dropped out of high school. What happens in an environment like that, John?
Yeah, the real and the problem you have to recognize. I want to address it. Boy, my mind's going to explode here. You have given me so much stuff.
I have a tendency. Forgive me.
What you need to realize is that the middle class is under duress. It's under attack right now. And what makes for a free, robust society where we can have people having jobs is the middle class. It's not the rich. It's not the poor. It's the middle class. And the middle class every day is being asked to carry more and more and more of this burden, while another whole class of people, now almost 50% of the electorate, is walking around with their hands out saying, dinero, por favor, okay?
Yep.
And this is unsustainable, Michael. This will destroy it. The other thing that's killing us everywhere is high taxation, but even more so is high inflation. And right now, you're talking about the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve has been in this process of quantitative easing. They've managed to sequester a lot of what we should be seeing in the way of raging inflation. And inflation, you know, we hear about this. We have to care about the poor. I do. But inflation chews the poor up alive when it comes in. They can't deal with it. So when you have the Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party people, they're both picking out a part of the equation. But what they don't understand is it's big business and big government in bed with the central bank. It's a triangle. And they always go after one or the other. I said it's a game of ménage à trois, you know?
Yes, and you're adding the fourth partner out, and that's the United Nations.
Oops, hold on, I killed my mic, sorry.
That's okay.
No, you're right. And what we're seeing is this transformation. When President Obama came in, I remember we were in Colorado. I went to Colorado. I got my press credentials to go to the Democratic convention at Mile High Stadium.
Right.
And we were sitting listening to Obama do his what I call I Am Apollo speech, because they put those silly-looking Greek pillars up on the stage there at Mile High.
Yep.
And as he was doing it, I said, Carol, do you recognize what he's doing? He's doing what we call in change agentry the process. And what he does is he starts off by saying we all need to work together and we need to be equal and we need to do these things. And then he immediately turns around and gives a backhanded slap to a group of people who aren't the people who are doing that. They are the dividers, not the uniters. Now, wait a minute. You just said you're uniting us, and you just divided off a whole class of people. But if you go back to an interview that Saul Alinsky did with National Public Radio back in 1972, Saul Alinsky tells you what change agents are all about. Friction makes the whole thing work. And what they do is they take left against right, fighting over issues when in reality both sides are being moved to a third destination that neither side suspects while they're in the little fights.
That was exactly what Hitler did during the Second World War with the Jews and other minorities.
And their denial, you know, what really kept the Jews in trouble. Remember, Hitler came to power in 1933. The Kristallnacht was 1938, and the Wannsee Conference, the Endlösung, or the final solution, didn't happen until 1941, January, was denial among the Jews of Germany and denial among the Christian clergy of Germany. It couldn't get that bad, was what they kept saying.
My first wife, who died of cancer, it's hard for me to believe this, in 2 days it will be 29 years that we lost her. Her mom and dad were in the Holocaust. And for the life of me, I said, how in the world did this happen? And they said, because everyone kept saying, it can't get worse. We'll
right,
get
but
through
if you
it, and it'll get
to what
better.
They, if you listened to what they said they were going to do, like Alinsky or President Obama, they were really telegraphing to you where they were going. And when President Obama uses the word transformation,
yes,
anybody who understands the process of change agentry, your head's going up because you're going, oh, well, wait a minute, what are we transforming into? What's our end goal? You mean it's not that good here? That was the other thing I was going to point out. You know, this the people who are running around yelling that we're all a nation of racists, homophobes, Islamophobes, just make it blankophobe. That's always the whatever the fill-in is. Now, these are the very same people who want unlimited illegal immigration into the country, or what they call, quote, reform, which means we're just going to rubber stamp it now. Now, if they were really consistent, Michael, all of those people who think we're such a horrible, imperialist, racist, unjust nation would be running to the border, lining it up, and holding their hands out to everyone coming across saying, stop, you don't want to come here, it's really bad. Why aren't they doing that? Okay.
Of course, because this is all part of the game plan. But look, Arlen Specter, I testified before Arlen Specter in the Senate Judiciary Committee, the late senator from Pennsylvania. And I will never forget, first of all, I was really upset with what they did. Before everybody was even seated, he told me I had the floor, which is normally not done. They obviously had me there because they needed to be able to say that there was balance to the hearing. I think I've done 15 or 16 hearings now before both the House and Senate. And at one point, Specter, just before he introduced me, as I recall, I'd have to look back at the videotape because I still believe it might be up online somewhere, said something about people who suffered from exophobia. I kid you not. And I almost started laughing because I thought, my God, the guy's afraid of the letter X. I thought we were back at Sesame Street or something. But what he, and then he corrected himself. I have a sick sense of humor. You need to understand that.
No, this warms my heart because four years I was responsible for technical quality on Sesame Street for the western half of public television.
Oh, right. So what he
anyway,
said, exophobia, I said, oh, my God, where's Elmo? But so, you know, then he corrected himself and said xenophobia. But, you know, this is what has happened with the language. You know, George Orwell had a couple of really great quotes about the use of language. The guy was absolutely brilliant. So he said, for example, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And freedom is the right to tell people what they do not want to hear. But then he had this really wonderful saying. It's about political language. So here's what George Orwell said. Political language, and with variations, this is true of all political parties, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. How does that work for you?
Yeah, and that's why you have to, the process is called obfuscation. That's what we used to call it in logic. And you obfuscate the question by diverting the answer. When do you ever hear a clear answer from a politician about anything?
The problem is this. But there's a problem, too. They want to be in 83 places simultaneously, and unless this is quantum physics, that's not possible. So they pass laws. You know, I was on with Lou Dobbs, and I was a regular on Lou's program when he was over at CNN. I was on with him, gosh, over 100 times. And I remember when they came out with the virtual fence, the Secure Border Initiative Network, SBINet, and Lou Dobbs, in that Lou Dobbs voice, said, Mike Cutler, what do you think of the virtual fence? And I said, Lou, it will do exactly what it's supposed to do. And he said, what's that? I said, cost a ton of money and stop virtually nobody. And a couple of years afterwards, the GAO came out with those findings. But what they do is they want to maintain status quo to satisfy the people that are lining their pockets with those campaign contributions. But they know that that's not what their constituents want. But they also know that the average American now has an attention span that's shorter than a goldfish. So they call it the Secure Border Initiative Network. It cost well over $1 billion. They go out to their constituents and they say, look it up. I just voted to spend $1.9, whatever the number is, $1 billion to secure that border. And everybody goes, yay. And they look it up, and sure enough, he voted for this bill. It's a boondoggle. This is the functional equivalent of hiring a bunch of house painters and they come to your house promptly at 8 a.m. as promised, and they're very neat, and they're very careful, and they're very polite, and they put out the drop cloths, and they come in immaculate clothing, and these guys are something to, it's like watching the Marine Corps drill team. They are something. But then you realize that after 3 weeks, they're still painting your living room, and you're paying them by the hour. And then you realize they've been using empty paint cans.
Yeah, I know. But do you remember the Grace Commission? Wasn't it 1990 when J. Peter Grace came out with that? And they proved, I mean, what he said is that he went through it as a businessman. Remember, it was an independent investigation, and he went through it. And when he got done, he said you could chop out 50% of the workforce just in the federal government alone, and we wouldn't even notice a difference in service. There's that much ineptitude and corruption in there, you know, right now. Some friends of mine.
But you have to blame the politicians, not the workers. That's what's so.
No, I agree. But you know what? I'll be really honest with you. I've got a friend who was working in here locally in the Northwest in a government office, and she said out of the five people in the office, two did the work and three sat around and colored their nails and talked about, you know, their boyfriends and stuff like that. So there's a way that people hide, and I agree, because there are certain areas, like I think certain areas function, the FAA functions, air traffic control functions, you know, certain levels of law enforcement functions. There are others that I think are just totally dysfunctional.
Well, but if they're dysfunctional, it's because they have been made to be dysfunctional. Immigration is a case in point. I cannot tell you how many people who are in the Border Patrol or how many ICE agents are out there that are furious. They understand full well the dangers to what is happening right now, okay? And they would go out tomorrow morning and put in an 80-hour week and be paid for 40 hours if only they could do the job. But they can't do the job. And so when the president makes these statements, and then some reporter said, well, you know, what you're doing is a contradiction with the law. Well, this is like being in the military. You follow your orders. Well, the Nuremberg defense didn't work. I mean, what happens when the president functionally says, okay, there's a budget shortfall for your agency's funding, so I want you to go out and rob banks? I mean, you know, what do we do then? What kind of quandary are we in? Because what's really happening now, think about this. We have a legal immigration system that's largely dysfunctional, that's overflowing with work that they can't deal with. And we have an illegal system that de facto is being managed by the very same federal government now. The federal government is almost to the point of being in bed with the alien smugglers, when you think about it. You have people massing to come to the United States. Intelligence comes up and they say, yep, we're going to get hit again. Well, you have intelligence, whether it's in law enforcement or the military, so that you can project what's happening. It's like leading the skeet when you go skeet shooting. So we're leading the skeet. We know where it's going to be. We know how to aim the gun to hit it. And instead of saying, okay, let's move resources in and shut down the border, Intel goes back to the White House and says, we're about to get swamped. And the White House says, okay, call days in and see how many reservations you can make.
Well, I mean, but that's the, yeah, no, I agree with that. But, you know, that's the nature of government. The real question now is how to, you know, because I'm not anarchist. I believe in the need for government and the rule
right.
of law.
Oh, I know you're not.
But we have several problems. Number one, we have too many laws and regulations. We can't know them all.
Right.
I interviewed an attorney last year who wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day. So the average American commits three felonies a day and they don't even know it, you know,
right.
just by what we do. Okay, so that's the first thing. Second thing is that now it's I really tend to think the Beltway's running out of control. It's running to its own beat. It doesn't care what people are doing. You should see some issues. We have a case that went national here, and I live in North Idaho, just on the east side of the Washington border and just south of Canada. And we had a man
Beautiful
who had
area.
Bought property. I love it here. I came from your neck of the woods, Teaneck, New Jersey, at one point.
Really?
But yeah. It was home. Most of my family.
A crazy guy, huh?
Yeah, I don't quite talk like that until I get around all my relatives again. Then I start talking more like that. You know.
There you go.
But when you talk on the radio, you have to speak yes. eruditely. You can't do that. You can't sound like you know. So anyways, the whole thing. But he bought a property. It had already been plumbed in with the plumbing. They had the permit. The septic and the field was tested. It was, a mile or so from Priest Lake, which is a big lake up in the north part of the state, out in the woods. And all of a sudden, the EPA comes swooping in and says, this isn't wet, but we declare it a conditional wetland. I mean, somebody literally, some bureaucrat just, you know, says, this is a wetland, and if you don't put everything back the way it was and stop building, we're going to charge you $37,000 a day in fines. And he's discovered there's no real appeal process for this. You see, this is that bureaucratic oligarchy I talked to you about, you know. Well, he stood his ground, became a national case, and I think that thing's ongoing. This is ridiculous. I keep wanting to say, don't you government agents understand that the hell you help create, your kids are going to have to live in? All right, that
but the
you
same
take
thing
an
is
oath.
True of the but look, it's true of the politicians also. Look at what's happening with Iran right now, by the way. For those of you not familiar, a ship that's really under the protection of the United States. It was a foreign flag, but not real. Was it a Marshall Island flag or whatever?
It was a Marshall Island flag, yeah. And we have a treaty with them that says we have to protect them.
Right. So that ship gets seized along with its crew by Iran going through the Straits of Hormuz, because they claim that they had some kind of a financial problem with the Marshall Islands, and they're going to get their money, so they're basically holding the ship for ransom now. So the U.S. government has turned around and said, okay, we're moving our ships into the area, they're going to escort these vessels through the Straits of Hormuz. Okay? But meanwhile, we are in negotiations with this intractable renegade regime that is the biggest sponsor of terrorism anywhere in the world, but we're going to negotiate with them in good faith because we certainly know that they can be trusted to hold up their end of the deal, right?
Right.
You know, I was born on a Wednesday, not last Wednesday, and look at the consequences. Imagine a nuclear Iran. Now, look at the other things that we're doing, though, because the politicians have been bought and paid for by the campaign contributions. And, you know, I always tell people, imagine you get pulled over by a cop for speeding, you offer the cop a 50 like a dummy, and you wind up in handcuffs, and rightfully so. On the other hand, the alternative is to pay the ticket, approach the mayor of that town, and say, hey, listen, here's a campaign contribution when you run for re-election, but I would love that speed limit to go from 50 to 75. And there's a very good chance they'll do it. So you tell me what's more corrupt, offering the cop the 50 or the politician a couple of thousand.
But, to bring this full circle, Michael, where this comes back to is we need to be able to talk about all of these issues and say, here's where the problem is and point the finger. That's what the politicians don't want. They don't want accountability.
Right.
Remember, there are three rules of any bureaucrat, okay? Number one is to give lip service to your public function. That includes politicians. Number two is to maintain your own existence, even at the expense of your public function, if necessary. And number three, when caught, to deny accountability. Those are the three rules. And you can watch them. These things just click off every single time. But until you have people who are willing to break the system, it's not going to happen. And our states, the governors of our states and the states are all tangled in the system. That's where it is. But you have to be able to tell people this is what's happening. And sooner or later, you can sometimes get a little reform in there. Because, you know, I'll be honest, countries go through these cycles, and they come to a point where they need to be reformed. And
there's a tipping point that gets reached. It's so bad that nobody can do. The little drop of rain that was coming through the roof on very heavy occasions, and people say, oh, just a little drop. Well, all of a sudden, there's a big kaboom, and you look up, and you can see the stars. Now you can't ignore it anymore.
That's correct, and it does. Now, the question is, can you, under a nation of laws like we are, do that reform peacefully, or does it have to be done violently? But one way or another, it will happen. Okay, that's the thing you need to understand, is that it just becomes unlivable, and they drive people into doing illegal things when they didn't have to, or try to squeeze them out. Usually taxation is the big issue, historically, where it's been. You know, I was thinking of Thomas Jefferson, too. You were talking about they've seized the ship from the Marshall Islands, and they're holding it. Now, think about Thomas Jefferson. I had the privilege of living in Tripoli, Libya for a year when I was growing up because my father was stationed at Wheelis Air Base there, and we lived in downtown Tripoli. We didn't live on base. And in right on the harbor there, they have on the old Crusader fort, they have a mount of the mast of the Philadelphia, the USS ship. Now, when the Tripoli pirates were raiding the U.S. ships and enslaving people, Jefferson didn't put up with it, okay? And he sent in a raiding party to deal with that. And in one daring raid, an American captain, we actually went in and sank one of our own ships to keep the Tripoli, the group, the people there, the pirates, from getting a hold of it. So the point is that's what we did. Today, West...
I hate to interrupt you, but I got to just ask you the one question.
Yeah.
Do you know why the Marines are called the Leathernecks?
No, I don't. You're going to have to tell me.
Well, it's consistent with what you just talked about. Because when the Marines went into Libya, there were concerns back then as well that they would be beheaded. So they wrapped their belts around their necks to protect their necks from the swords of the pirates.
I didn't know that. Well, that's interesting now. Now you've got me on that one. So, but that's all where we get the Marine hymn. So the whole point of the whole thing being this is where we're at. What's really critical for us right now is not as much left and right issues. Those we can debate if we're allowed to have debate. But on college campuses, a lot of times you're not allowed to have that debate. When speakers come in that are unpopular, they try to push them off campus. Or if that doesn't work, they come in and there's disruption that goes on in these speeches. We can't allow this in a free society. You know,
I was with Jim Gilchrist at Central Washington University outside of Seattle. And Jim is something of a character. I like the guy, but he's a character. And he said, Mike, would you like to come and debate me? I said, well, I don't know that there's much of a debate here. I think we both want the border secure. But by the way, here's another good one. Once we secure the border, then we can give all the people who are here lawful status. How many border states do we have, John? You know?
Yeah, I know.
It's the subterfuge. They're telling you if we partially plug one hole in the bottom of that colander, and I wrote about this for Front Page Magazine, if you plug one of those holes in that colander that you use for draining your pasta, now you can use it as a bucket to carry not just water, but even a deadly fluid that if any leaks out will probably kill people. Is there anybody stupid enough to think that plugging one hole in the bottom of a colander will convert it into a safe bucket?
No, but it carries politically. Yeah, a couple of summers ago, we were up on the visiting some friends right up on the Canadian border, out in the woods is where their home is. They don't have power. They have solar. And they're just west of Glacier Park, where you were just recently.
Oh, that's so spectacular up there. Gosh.
And as you're sitting on their deck, you can actually look at the cut, the border cut at 49 degrees north between Canada and the U.S. as it goes right along the woods and up over the mountains there. You can actually sit on their deck and see this. So I said to my wife, come on, let's go up to the border. Let's go see what's going on. I want to see what the Border Patrol's doing, right? So we go up there, and right as we get to the right where the border is, the Border Patrol's unloading horses and their helicopters flying around and everything else. And I thought, holy cow. This is just, even between the U.S. and Canada, is miles and miles and miles of wilderness, not to mention the Mexican border. How can you possibly control this thing without a change of attitude, you know?
Well, the way you control it, the key to all of this, because people say, well, how do you do this? And I said, look, you don't have enough people in America to stand hand in hand and secure the border. And now let's not forget the coastline also. And let's not forget the international airports also. But the key is interior enforcement, and not just E-Verify. See, people want simple answers, E-Verify. And, I was speaking at an event in Pennsylvania. This was interesting. And there was this grizzled old guy who was in his 80s. And, you know, we've all seen this guy, the body language, right? His legs are crossed, his arms are folded across his chest, his head is cocked to one side. And to add to the image, the guy had a patch on one eye, I swear. And he's looking at me, scowling the whole time, and I said, look, I'll speak for 30 to 40 minutes, and then I'll take questions. Well, I'm 5 minutes into what I had to say, and he jumps up, and he says, God damn it, if the guys that were with me in Korea were here now, we'd lock that border down in 30 days. You're making much too much of it. And so I started to explain all the components of the program, and his jaw dropped. Because what really needs to be done is there's got to be interior enforcement, not just E-Verify, but the way we give people lawful status, which brings me to a story that just happened in Ohio. And I was hoping that Fox News would talk about it, but they wouldn't. See, even Fox won't talk about a lot of stuff. MSNBC and CNN are off the scope. They're gone. They're finished. There was a time when I could have done a dozen to 15 television programs in a month. I'd be going from Fox to MSNBC, back to CNN, and then I'd get a call from the producer at Fox to go back there for another show. Now, if I do 15 TV programs in a year, it's a lot, with one exception. And for all my listeners, go to Newsmax TV. J.D. Hayworth has now moved to prime time, 8 to 9 o'clock, and Verizon, DirecTV, they're all carrying Newsmax TV now. They and One American News Network are attempting to give Fox a run for the money. And J.D. Hayworth was a member of Congress. In fact, he was one of the people who attended this hearing that I testified at 6 weeks after 9/11, before the Immigration Reform Caucus. So I'm on with him roughly once a week now. So he does cover the topic. But other than that, there's no coverage. There's an absolute news blackout, so people don't understand the issue. But I did start to mention it on Newsmax. I hope to get back to this with them next week. There was, and you probably saw it in the news, a Somali young man who was arrested by the FBI as he returned from Syria in Ohio. And he was he's being prosecuted thus far, and of course they could always issue a superseding indictment. But right now he's facing three counts, two counts of supporting terrorism, one count of lying to an FBI agent. The remarkable thing, and this is what infuriates me, is that this guy was not charged with lying on his application for United States citizenship. And this is critical. Not because I want to see an immigration criminal prosecution. I mean, I have no problem with that. I certainly did enough criminal prosecutions as an agent. In fact, I worked with Al D'Amato to make reentry a 20-year felony instead of just a 2-year felony when we're dealing with criminal aliens. So, you know, I believe in prosecuting these crimes. But in this case, there's a practical reason. This guy went to Syria to fight over there. They trained him, taught him how to do home break-ins so he could get his hands on guns, and then said, once you get those guns, we want you to kill soldiers and law enforcement in the United States. If we don't prosecute the guy for lying on his application for citizenship, when he gets out of jail, he's still an American, and we do not deport Americans. On the other hand, if we can also indict and successfully prosecute him for lying on the application, we can then strip him of his U.S. citizenship. And then when he comes out of jail, we can deport him from the United States, which I think is wonderful, because I don't think we need this guy who's here, a man on a mission to kill us from within our own borders. To have him wandering around gives me cause for pause. The question, why in the world did not the prosecutor, while they were in front of the grand jury, raise this issue? You know, it's like you're going to the supermarket and they say, John, while you're there getting paper towels and laundry detergent, could you please swing by the ice cream aisle? I'm out of ice cream, and I've really got a hankering for some French vanilla. And you'd say, sure, Mike, I'm going to be in the store anyway. They were in front of the grand jury anyway. Why not prosecute the guy at that moment in time and charge him with lying on the application so he then becomes amenable to deportation? You see, the narrative is that immigration has nothing to do with terrorism, which is a lie. Look at the 9/11 Commission report and findings. You know, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And then I had a go around with the producer at 60 Minutes. I called up because I don't know if you saw where Leslie Stahl interviewed Jay Johnson. Did you see that program?
I didn't see that one.
Well, instead of hitting him with cannonballs, she was hitting him with wiffle balls. And I had the privilege of about a half dozen wonderful conversations with Mike Wallace over the phone. Never met him in person. I'm so sorry. I never had the chance to sit down with him. But he would call me, and I called him. And one of our conversations went on for an hour and a half, and it was wonderful. And he was a big fan of what I was trying to do after 9/11. But Leslie had so many missed opportunities. Didn't ask him about how is it helping national security to give millions of people identity documents without so much as a face-to-face interview. Didn't ask them why they're still buying more drones, even after the GAO said drones are worthless and very expensive. It would be far more effective and far cheaper to buy manned helicopters. I mean, I can think of 20 great questions she could have asked him. Didn't ask him one of those. And this guy called me back. To his credit, he did call me back. And I said to him, he said to me, are you going to tell me, Mr. Cutler, that you really believe that people that are running the border because they're desperate want to do harm to us? I said, do you believe that everybody that runs the border wants to mow your lawn? I said, how big is your lawn anyway? And he didn't know what to say to me. But he absolutely refused to accept the findings of the 9/11 Commission. I read to him a passage from the 9/11 Commission. And I said, you know that immigration was discovered or found to be by the 9/11 Commission the key vulnerability that not only allowed terrorists to enter the United States but embed themselves here, hide in plain sight. He said, I really have a problem with that notion. I said, so you're disputing the 9/11 Commission? There was a long pause, and he said, I got another phone call.
Well, you're going to face that, and what it's going to take is, unfortunately,
politicians,
it's going to take another attack of, you know, you're talking about stuff coming into the harbors and things. I thought, you know, porta nukes aren't too hard to arrange. Put one in one of those big containers.
Yep.
Are we going to scan it and get all of those by secondary radiation and figure something's out? What's coming across our borders elsewhere?
We have no idea, and we have no control over anything. And by the way, do you really need to bring a weapon here? Do you bring sand to the beach? You know, we're educating our adversaries. And, you know, 60 Minutes did a story last week, very interesting, about how China is developing anti-satellite capabilities. In fact, they destroyed one of their own satellites and created so much debris that it's really a problem now for the manned space program and other satellite programs. And so now they're saying that the Chinese are in the position to be able to go after the geosynchronous satellites that are orbited at 22,300 miles up. And here's my question that I'd love to know. How many of the scientists working on that program for China were educated in the United States? According to immigration, we have 1.1 million foreign students studying in the United States. The number one country that sends us their students, that accounts for the bulk of the students, is China, followed by India, followed by South Korea. Saudi Arabia is in the top five or the top ten. So if our schools are so lousy that we can't produce the scientists, engineers, and STEM professionals we need, why is it that those countries, our adversaries, if you will, are having their students come to America to be educated? Because it's a big lie. If you want to know about Bill Gates, if you think Bill Gates is a philanthropist, as I've said in the past, then you believe that the guy that puts cheese on a mousetrap is trying to feed hungry mice. Gates is an opportunist. Gates is grammatically challenged. He can only conjugate verbs in the first person singular. So the other day I was having a discussion with somebody that I work with over at CAPS, and I said to Maria, Gates is not this nice guy, benevolent guy that everyone seems to think he is. She said, well, look at all the charitable work he does in Africa. So I got off the phone, and here's something for you to try. Punch into Google Microsoft Africa, see what you come up with. And you will see how Microsoft, just put in Microsoft and then Africa, dash Africa. And you will see what Gates is doing in Africa. They're starting their own television network. They're doing all sorts of things because he is developing a new consumer market, and I'm sure it won't be long before he has factories there, and he's looking to dig natural resources out of the ground in Africa. He is not doing this out of benevolence. You know, if you this is like, did you see the Twilight Zone episode, The Serve Man?
Well, I probably did, but I don't remember directly.
Okay, well, the premise is, we have a little bit of time. I have 90 minutes today. You can stay with me as long as you want, or if you need to go, I understand. But
okay.
I just want to get to this. I'm enjoying our conversation, I have to tell you, John. Extraterrestrials land on the Earth, and they come in flying saucers, and they're big, and they're nice people wearing these robes, and they're all carrying this big book around. And finally, one of them leaves a book somewhere, and our people get a hold of it, and they figure out, all of our experts in language and linguistics figure it out, and the cover says to serve man. And they're showing us how to create more food with less land and more power that's clean, and we're thinking, wow, these are our benefactors. They are amazing. Look at how they're helping us. And then they want to organize a tour so we can see their planet. And everybody signs up for a trip to their planet. They're getting
I know what the book is.
It's a cookbook.
it's a cookbook
to
right.
serve man.
Oh, it's interesting. Okay, but now here's the question. Where do we go from here? I always ask people that because, you know, you and I can talk about this, Michael. What's the recommendation? What's the solution to that?
Okay, the solution is this. We need to confront the politicians and tell them, look, we know what you're up to. When Gutierrez had that news conference or that town hall meeting about a month ago, if you remember, and it was in Spanish. People who were going to the town hall meeting called me up, and they said, what do? We're going to this town hall meeting. Now, they didn't know it was going to be in Spanish. So I gave them a list of questions they should ask. And one of the questions that we should all ask our elected representatives, they start to talk about immigration, ask them, you think this is going to help the economy? Okay, how does what you want square with the 9/11 Commission report, number one? Number two, when you don't have enough jobs to go around, how does bringing in more workers help create more jobs? Okay? Number three, when you talk about how this would stimulate the economy, you know that if you go to the UN website, the two fastest ways to move money from the American economy to the third world, according to the UN and the World Bank, is sustainability and comprehensive immigration reform. How would siphoning money off of our economy to the third world help stimulate the economy? Didn't we have an economic stimulus package that was supposed to dump money into the economy to stimulate it? So what happens when you pull money out of the economy? And last year, between $125 and $200 billion was wired out of the United States by foreign workers. If you add in the multiplier effect, without even looking at wage suppression or the displacement of American workers, those remittances, that money being wired out of the country, would roughly account for the annual increase in America's national debt all by itself. What happens when there are more foreign workers sending more money out of the country? How does that stimulate the economy? And I said, so what you need to do is to go to these news conferences, these town hall meetings. And in the old days, bringing a video camera was cumbersome. I had one of the original ones, the two-piece unit, the door folded down with a little keyboard. Now you've got a cell phone. All you do is videotape it on your cell phone and put it on YouTube. So when these people got to that town hall meeting with Mr. Gutierrez, and it was going to be done in Spanish, and they were handing out headphones for those unfortunate enough who only could speak English in America. And by the way, I'm an advocate for learning multiple languages, and I know you have a background in Spanish and other languages. I think it's wonderful. I learned how to speak Yiddish because my parents used it as a secret language, and I had to learn Spanish when I went to Border Patrol Academy. I think that the more we learn, the better we are. But we need a common language, otherwise we have a Tower of Babel. And so when he pulled that stunt, everybody that had been in the car that I was talking to, they had me up on speakerphone, told their friends, and everybody whipped out their cameras and started to videotape Gutierrez trying to hold a town hall meeting in Spanish. It's about making these people accountable. When the mayor of Baltimore said, I've given these people the freedom to destroy things, and the next day she said, I never said that. Of course, Fox News immediately ran the videotape of what she said the day before. That's exactly what she said. How stupid is that? You're standing in front of a bunch of TV cameras, and now the next day you say, I didn't say that? I mean, what level of brain damage does that take? See, this woman, I think, flunks the Wiggle test. Are you familiar with the Wiggle test, John?
Yeah, I am. That's what I'm wondering. Well, that's the advantage that we have of events. When you see them happening, now people can make a recording of it right then and there. That's something we couldn't do before.
And it's irrefutable. And it's
right.
Now what are you going to say? You're saying you didn't say it? Let's go to the videotape, as what's-his-face Wolf used to say, the sports commentator.
Right, Wolf Blitzer.
Go to the
videotape. But
so
that's
how you make them accountable. And once
and
you
that's
destroy
why, by
their
the way,
credibility,
they,
they're gone.
That's why, by the way, I'm always alert for efforts to try to regulate the Internet. You know, we just went through this FCC thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Where, well, you could,
and talk radio.
Because,
absolutely.
Right. Politicians don't like this. Remember, when we first went into broadcasting, my wife and I met working for a TV network, but we went in and you had three main networks plus public television, and there was mutual broadcasting on radio in addition to the regular three. If you didn't get your news through those three, you didn't get it anywhere for the most part. Mm-hmm. What has happened is, first of all, talk radio, they thought it was going to die, but in the 80s, the conservative crowd and the libertarians all found talk radio. And then in the 90s, Internet newspapers and the ability to listen to radio shows from cities that you're not in, you know, where you can actually listen to somebody's show
streaming
on the Internet.
Sure. Well, that's what I do. Absolutely.
It's changed all of that. Most of my listening is not from this part of the country. I go to specific shows where I get a lot of information. One of the ones that I say everybody should go to is Frank Gaffney in the Center for Security Policy and what he's tracking there, because he has a one-hour podcast three times a week, you know, called, I forget what the name of the thing is, but I listen to it faithfully just to see, because he has terrific guests on. That's what the Internet has done, and politicians don't like that. See, they're having a harder time hiding behind the wall of lies they put up. I remember when I was doing talk radio in the early part of the 90s that the London Telegraph, it was Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who now does their financial reporting from Europe, but he was in Washington as their bureau correspondent. And he had originally been a Clinton supporter, and then he began to cover the nonsense and shenanigans that were going on in the Clinton administration. And so all of us who were talk show hosts here had friends in Great Britain, because this is before the Internet, and every day we'd be on the phone to them, to London or somewhere else, saying, please fax us Ambrose Evans Pritchard's column today. And it got so bad, so much of an embarrassment, because the Washington Post wasn't covering it, that the Washington Post actually attacked the Telegraph and Pritchard because, again, why? They're trying to shut him up because they weren't doing their job. And that's what everybody, Michael Reagan, I was doing it, we're all, you know, saying, please fax us his articles, you know, because that's the way we can get on the air and talk about it. That's why it's wonderful what we have, and they don't like that, and that's the important part.
Well, do you remember Trent Lott actually partnered with Nancy Pelosi to put an end to talk radio?
Well, that was the whole issue of the fairness doctrine.
Right.
The fairness doctrine came from a time in broadcasting when you did have only a limited number of outlets, radio and television, and they would do an editorial, usually a one-minute or two-minute, probably a one-minute editorial, at night. You know, this is John Frump, general manager of, you know, KRUD, Crud Radio, with an editorial about so-and-so, and he would give his opinion. Well, they felt that other people should have access to it that may have a dissenting opinion, so they had to offer equal time. That's
right.
No longer the case, and the goal of the fairness doctrine now is to try to dilute the ability of their enemies, their opponents, to be able to talk, by loading them down with regulations that every time they said anything on the air on a talk show, they'd have to provide equal time for somebody else from a counter opinion. Can you imagine the nightmare of trying to keep track of everything any talk show host said on his show every day?
Right.
Okay. So that's and that's why they were trying to get rid of that. You know, every once in a while, you need to understand this whole new process we're headed toward is delivered with what I call a smiley fist. You know, you're all familiar with the smiley face, right?
Sure.
Okay. So, but right behind it, the smiley face is painted on a fist. And if you violate the terms of it, pow, they'll get you with it. Don't believe all this nice, good, we care about people talk. That's nonsense. That's blather. That's for public consumption.
Look at Mike Bloomberg. Mike Bloomberg stood there jumping up and down about salt and sugar, right, the big gulp drinks. But, you know, I find it so remarkable that he was so concerned about our health and well-being. I admit that I like that third spoonful of sugar in my morning coffee. But what's more dangerous, that third spoonful of sugar or the guy that's taking a spoonful of cocaine and shoving it up his nose? And yet you never heard a word about heroin. You never heard a word about cocaine coming out of Mike Bloomberg's mouth. Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, I know. So.
If you look at all the things that they're saying, it's not about what's good for the public. It's what's good for them politically. That's all they care about. What do I have to do in order to get the campaign contribution? They are as addicted to money in politics today as the crack addict hooker. They want money, and they work at it 24/7. Fundraisers every weekend, because they know that the only way to win elections is to have the money so they can buy the airtime, and it's about winning elections, not about truly governing.
And the same thing is true about the bills we pass. We need a constitutional amendment that allows a bill to only cover one subject when you're passing it. None of these
the
mega bills.
The line item veto. Reagan tried to get that for the longest time.
Right. He had that in California, and it worked. Reagan took George Brown, that was Jerry Brown's father, the current governor, George Brown had spent the state into a deficit, And Reagan came in and he said, we're going to fix this. And his chief target was the waste and squandering that went on in the state college system. Well, you've never heard such howling and screaming in your life, okay, about this is the end of education as we know it, you know. Well, when he left office, education still stood. They got rid of a lot of the bloat. They had a balanced budget. They actually had a real surplus, not a fictitious one, when he left. And then Governor Moonbeam, Jerry Brown, came in, and they said, look at all this money. And they've been, and now, of course, the I think California at one time was the third or fourth largest economy, Michael, in the world. And now it's down around seventh or eighth and sliding. If the U.S. is the Titanic, California is the bow. And the reason for that is you have to watch California. As California goes, so goes the nation. They have driven businesses out by imposing upon them so much regulation they can't handle it, and taxes. The tax rates are some of the highest in the country. They have a huge flood of people moving into the state seeking state benefits. And what they've done now, you know, they talk about the we care about everybody. Well, horse rot on that. You have the uber rich who can afford the economic abuse. They have business and property there. And then you have this lower class developing. The middle class is under real stress, but they're driving jobs out. Now, whichever way they go, even this water crisis they have is something of their own making. You know,
they're running around
blaming global warming and all of this other stuff. No, you've mismanaged your water policy.
And you have too many people that you can't support.
It's, you know, California gets its water from two places, either the Sierras, which is on the east side up in the north, or the Colorado River. And the Colorado River is already drained dry by the time it gets to the Sea of Cortez. You know, it starts in Colorado and flows down through the Grand Canyon and then out into the Sea of Cortez there, and they've already tapped it off. The only other thing is groundwater, and Arizona's doing the same thing. There are going to be some really fierce water wars coming. We know this even in the Northwest, and we're, pardon the pun, swimming in water, okay, up here. But we still have the same issue as to who gets to use what. The Northwest, we have the highest annual rainfall of the whole continental lower 48 states. So this is what we're facing, but you have to watch California because these are the policies that they're telling us they want nationally, and it's not working. I keep wondering why California hasn't gone under revenue-wise already. I'm sitting here going, how are they doing this? Because
and by the way,
bonds aren't worth it.
You were talking about global warming, and nobody questions anything. Here's my contention. You know, I was a science guy originally. My oldest son's an engineer. My youngest is studying engineering. I was going to be an engineer. The scientific method means you have to eliminate all of the variables you're testing for, but all the variables, but for the one you're testing for. We don't even know all the variables that go into climate. And I'm not saying that we're not experiencing global warming. I'm not even saying that human activity isn't possibly contributing to what's happening. Maybe. The problem is maybe. And we're making a lot of decisions that are suppressing wages and the economy and everything else on the presumption that the models they've created are right. And there are variances. I spoke to a scientist about it. I said, what happened in 1999? He said, oh, I knew you were going to ask me. Well, it didn't coincide with the model. I said, do you know why it didn't? He said, well, truthfully, no. I said, then maybe the model is wrong. So look at what we're doing. Nobody questions anything. As long as the guy stands up and says, I'm a scientist. I mean, look at the commercials for the medications that they peddle on the TV. They put some guy in a white jacket with a stethoscope who probably had a third-grade education, and he looks very serious, and they tell you about all these great pills you can take if your eyes don't pop out of your head and if you don't start bleeding from your ears. I mean, you ever listen to the disclaimers?
Yeah, I do. I do. Like, why would I want to
God.
Take this thing? But let me tell you about the background of to the whole global warming thing, okay? The whole thing traces to the concept of...
Are you about to tell me that it's all a bunch of hot air, by the way?
I'm going to tell you, no, the planet's been heating since the middle of the 1700s, but it was cooling from about the 1200s to the 1700s, and then it reversed. It's a long-term, thousand-year cycle. The concept of global warming and sustainability, it was Gro Harlem Brundtland, the former prime minister of Norway and a big member of the Socialist International, involved with these United Nations commissions that first came up with the idea of sustainability. They can't define it well enough. It's anything they want it to mean. Now, right about that time, one scientist, wasn't it Hansen, I think, from NASA, came up with the idea of global warming. And immediately the United Nations glommed onto it. We didn't have evidence for it, okay? We hadn't proven it. We hadn't modeled it. We didn't have the computer power at the time. But by 1992, the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development happened in Rio de Janeiro. That was an economic conference. And the idea was the United States has caused all of the wreckage that we see environmentally in the world. Therefore, the U.S. has to pay for it, and therefore we need a wealth transfer system. From that point on, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was tasked not to find whether there's global warming, but it was tasked to find man-made causes only for global warming. And at that point, once they decided by consensus, that was it. It was off and running. There was never a debate.
And of course, they give grants to people that can prove the theory that they want them to prove. So there's a financial.
That's precisely it. And there were billions upon billions of dollars have been poured into this global warming thing. You know, they say, well, these opponents are being funded by the oil companies. Oh, yeah, what about the others? What about the carbon tax? What about blah, blah, blah? And right this week, we had this confab at the Vatican. Pope Francis is getting suckered into it, in which Ban Ki-moon, the U.N. Secretary General, got up and said, our models show that we're going to raise the planet 4.5 to 5 degrees Celsius. And I said, what? Okay, because that's 8 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the most extreme side of the model. Those models are not coming true. It's not going to be anywhere near that side of a model. And he's spouting off all these facts. Do you know why? They're drooling. They want a global carbon tax, Michael. And you
sure,
can see the Pope.
And that's exactly what the World Bank and the UN said. Sustainability will be the fastest way of getting money out of the United States and other first world countries. So look at what's happened, okay? We know what this is about. And this is like covering a looting, a riot, okay? Let's say you were looking at Baltimore, and they're showing this guy that's on welfare with a big screen TV and a brand new computer in his house, and everyone says, isn't that neat? While ignoring that they just trashed the store that this family was depending on for their own sustenance. This is the looting of the United States of America, aided and abetted by our own politicians who are being bought off with campaign contributions. And then you have to ask yourself about Hillary and all the foreign money that seems to be pouring into her coffers, and she won't answer any questions. These are legitimate questions, don't you think?
Well, you have to be able to answer them, but that is why the concept of consensus and what we call political correctness, meaning there is orthodox speech and unorthodox speech. Unorthodox speech will not be tolerated, and the goal is to shut down dissent and to destroy. We used to call these red herrings, ad hominem attacks, whatever you want to call them. They're simply designed to not have to give the hardball answers. If you ask a climate scientist, where is the smoking gun that shows that human activities are the cause of this whole thing, and whether or not the models are actually model anything correctly, which, by the way, they're not. We've been in almost a 17-year hiatus. The temperatures have been flat now for almost two decades. Okay, they can't answer that question. And so they say, well, the majority of scientists believe. Excuse me, hello, but science is not a vote. Or could I go talk to this Mr. Science, please? Well, you can't. Well, why? You're always saying science says this and science says that.
Yep.
Well, okay. Well, it's just scientists. Well, do all the scientists agree? Well, most of them. Well, what about the ones who don't? You know, see, you and I both know how to go down this trail, right?
Sure. And then, by the way, and when President Obama wants something done, we all agree on whatever. And I'm always thinking, we? Who's we? Do you have a mouse in your pocket?
But good. See,
the problem that we have of the two most frequently cited sources when people argue these days are I've heard and they say. And you look at people and you say, really? Is that the best source you can come up with? I've heard and they say?
Well,
so
but that's...
We really got a problem. But to go back to your question, I really believe that if enough people could confront the politicians and have it on videotape and say, look, this doesn't make sense. Tell Jeb Bush, you're talking about how this is good for the economy? How? Even Stuart Varney, as soon as they pass comprehensive reform... How? I like Krauthammer. I think he's an amazing guy, and when you look at his life story, he's so inspirational. But they make these statements. Well, if an alien's been living in the United States for 7 years and paying his taxes, how will you know? No face-to-face interview, no field investigation, and the person may have used six multiple false names. How do you know if he got here 6 weeks ago or 6 years ago? And the answer is, you won't know. You won't
know. Right. So you can't enforce this, so it's not enforceable right from the start. So the whole thing's an absurd fiction, and we're going to all
right.
have to... Yeah,
that's right. So, in other words, it's like you or I saying, well, when we get to Mars, this is what we've got to do first. And then you look at me and you say, wait a second, Mike, we still don't have that rocket. Oh, darn. So you're making all these plans, but you have no way of getting there. If your fundamental underlying idea is, well, if someone's been living here for 7 years, then would you be willing to do it if the guy was here for 7 days? And, of course,
well,
the guy's
same.
Going to say no. And yeah. So then you say to him, well, how do you know that the guy's been here for 7 years? And
the
answer is there's no way of knowing.
There's no way of knowing it. But the same thing I have with elections and having a voter ID at the polls. Okay,
yep.
There's such yelling about this. I said, well, why is that? Well, you're depriving people of their right to vote. No, I'm not.
Right, this is wage. this is voter suppression. No, it's not. No, it's
you
not.
Have a right to vote. If you're a citizen of the state and the country in which we are here, you have a right to vote. When I drive, I have to prove that I have a right to drive. When I enter or leave the country, I have a passport. I have to show somebody that I'm a U.S. citizen.
When I carry a firearm in New York, I have to have my carry permit with me. Yes.
Right. So what? And you know what? You can get an ID from any Department of Motor Vehicles in the country. Okay,
and
it's not hard to do.
And they will do it for free for those people who can't afford it.
Yeah. So that's not it. But you know why? Because they want illegals to vote, and they want
yes.
them to vote in a particular way. That's why.
Well, there's just to say, I'm just going to wrap it up with this. You know, there's an old saying, it's not whether you win or lose, but how you play the game. Not anymore. Now it's all about winning at any cost.
That's what it is. That's what healthcare was about. They knew it was a messed up program, but we just had to get that football across the goal line, and then knowing that once it was in place, unraveling it or vetoing it would be very, very difficult. That's all they were trying to do.
Remarkable.
You know, so. Anyway, our website, by the way.
I'm looking at the clock. We're almost out of time. I have to tell you, it was a delight joining you for this 90-minute segment, as it turned out to be.
Well, I told my producer today, I said, usually I say, I wonder what I'm going to talk about on the show. And now I said, Michael Cutler won't have any lack of things to talk about, I'm sure. By the way, our website is steelonsteel.com if people want to visit it. We do a 90-minute weekly. I gave up doing daily talk radio. It just wore me out. So
yeah, no, that's understandable. But Steel on Steel, correct?
Yep, Steel on Steel, just like the metal, .com. And
perfect.
We cover economics, politics, and religion, and we show how they're all interacting with each other.
That's really amazing. And this course is so vital, folks. So visit John's website, and, you know, I want you, of course, to come back here again same time next week for the Michael Cutler Hour. But go to those websites, michaelcutler.net, capsweb.org. You know, we were talking about California and how it seems to be setting the pace for America. You go to the capsweb.org website. And they cover all the issues, whether it's the environment, whether it's education, whether it's the problem with the drought, certainly immigration, that's my bailiwick. Great website, Progressives for Immigration Reform, Front Page Magazine, who am I leaving out? It's about becoming educated, folks, so that we can then make certain that we can get the politicians to understand that we are not as dumb as they hope that we are. All I'm going to tell you, folks, have a great weekend. And make certain to get involved. Democracy, as I always like to point out, most definitely is not a spectator sport. One final plug: check out Newsmax TV. It's a great network, and they're doing their best to get the word out there. John Loeffler, I wish you and yours a very happy weekend. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you next week. So long for now.